Work.
Perfect. Okay, so this is our third class on the Bar Kokhba Revolt. No prior background in any of the previous classes is required, but we'll refer back to some, not just the previous two classes, but we'll refer back to some of the classes that we've done last semester, but I'll make sure to explain everything as we go. The issue that I want to deal with in this class is essentially going to build upon some of the things that we've already touched, but it will serve as a jumping off point for our investigation of the development, in this case, more along separate tracks rather than parallel tracks, although tracks that I think still have much to gain from each other until the 4th century, of Judaism and Christianity. What we're going to explore here, tonight in particular, is a... the best term, I suppose, would be historical, a thesis often adopted by historians and theologians for the last several hundred years, over 1,000 years, regarding the eventual parting of Judaism and Christianity. The Bar Kokhba Revolt, in particular, is seen as a pivotal moment in the history of Judaism and Christianity, in that it serves as a historical, scholarly, methodological panacea for all of the problems that plague the history of Judaism and Christianity up until this point. And by that I mean, it allows a simple, as we'll see, I think, simplistic way of modeling how Judaism and Christianity, if they were going to split from each other, how that would have occurred. So we've devoted all of our time this semester and last semester to explaining how it is not just possible, but necessary to speak of Judaism, and then within the context of Judaism, different groups and different strains and different emphases, one of which is Christianity up until this period. But at a certain point, we're going to have to talk about separation between Jews and Christians, and then the crystallization eventually of those two entities as distinct from one another definitionally. But the question is, how did that occur? So everything we've seen until now should indicate that it not only shouldn't occur at this point, but it perhaps couldn't occur at this point. So what we're going to have to investigate is how the Bar Kokhba Revolt might serve as an explanation for how Judaism and Christianity could part ways. And then we're going to have to explore, in addition to that, why, let's say perhaps, why we might, what sort of problems with this theory we might identify. So the jumping off point for our investigation is going to be this. What role did Christians play during the Bar Kokhba Revolt? So now recall, the Bar Kokhba Revolt is between the years 132 to 135 of the Common Era. We've just gotten through discussing the context, the Jewish context out of which Jesus sprung. We got through discussing the cause of the Bar Kokhba Revolt, which we identified as the founding of by the Roman Emperor Hadrian of the city Ilia Capitolina, a pagan city with a pagan temple on top of the ruins of Yerushalayim in the Beis HaMikdash. We discussed the zeitgeist, which was essentially, if not outright anti-Semitic, then at least discouraging of traditional expressions of Judaism, and we discussed circumcision in this connection. So what we're going to discuss here is what are the implications of this for understanding Christianity. So now the common thesis that is advocated often and robustly is this. Christians, well, actually, let's see if we can figure it out. Now, what might a person who doesn't know anything about the history of Judaism and Christianity and just knows what Judaism is today and what Christianity is today, what attitude towards Bar Kokhba might we assume Christians would have had?
Join them.
Why?
They were Jews.
So let's prescind for a moment from all of the things that we know, because we've spent a lot of time investigating them. What do we know about Christianity today? Christianity believes in what? Christianity has a God in three parts. We're going to discuss this more when we discuss the Council of Nicaea. But most importantly, we know that Christianity believes that what has already occurred, what has already arrived,
the Messiah.
Now, what do we know or think we know about Bar Kokhba? Some people held, maybe everybody held, that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah as well, was Mashiach as well. So, if you're a Christian who believes that the Messiah is already here, and you are confronted with a movement spearheaded by a person who claims to be the Messiah, what should your attitude be towards that person? You're right, you should oppose him. you should oppose him. So the default assumption of historians and theologians going all the way back to the church fathers, as we'll see in a moment, was that Christians would have, as a matter of course, not just opposed Bar Kokhba, but perhaps might have paid the price for opposing Bar Kokhba, because, after all, Bar Kokhba is going to be a successful Messiah. He can't have all these renegade Christians, or perhaps Christian Jews, running around saying that somebody else is the Messiah. That would be antithetical to the entire project of Bar Kokhba. So, what we... No.
Christians didn't want to antagonize the Romans, and one of the things that the gospel writers did was try to show that Christians were actually loyal Roman citizens, and it was the Jews who were anti-Roman, and so I would think that they would be a little bit reluctant to join in the
Republican. Right, so Malvina is making a good point, but we're going to have to distinguish the two sort of textual layers in what you're saying. Malvina is saying that the Christians... and you use the term Gospels. The Christians were generally attempting to portray themselves as loyal Roman citizens in contradistinction to the Jews. So now that, I think, would be... that wouldn't necessarily... That's an important point because we're going to develop it in just a moment. But that wouldn't be true for the Gospels. The Gospels, in fact, as we saw when we discussed Jesus himself and his attitude towards Gentiles and how that develops in the thought of Paul, we saw that Jesus initially has very negative attitudes towards Gentiles.
But the gospel writers, or some of the gospels, blaming the Jews for killing Jesus, and not the Romans. Romans were being excused from that, and so on. So
what we saw in the what we did see in the gospels was that the distinction between Christians and Jews. The distinction between Christians and Jews may be anachronistic when we talk about the Gospels, because in the Gospels there are no Christians versus Jews, there are Jews, and then some of the Jews follow Jesus, and some of the Jews follow Sadducees, some of them are Pharisees. And in fact, what we saw in the Gospels was that there develops, let's say in Acts, which we discussed when we examined the thought of Paul and Peter and James, was that at a certain point, I think you are correct to notice that the Gospels betray a certain attitude towards the Gentiles that sees them as being part of the covenant, as part of the chosen people, such that the notion of a chosen people essentially is obliterated. But the attitude towards Caesar, towards the Roman imperial family, that the Gospel doesn't have much to say about. At a certain point in the second century, however, you are correct, and we're going to develop this in just a moment, the church fathers, especially beginning with Justin Martyr, whose words we're going to examine in 2 seconds, and eventually Eusebius, whose words we're going to see, the great church fathers and church historians do take that approach, and that shapes their presentation of the attitudes of the Jews during this period. In other words, if we find portrayals of Jewish activity and attitudes during this period in the mouths of the church fathers, we have to be aware that the Christian church fathers are biased, or at least have an agenda, in terms of presenting the Jews in a certain light so that Christians can look a certain way. Yes?
But didn't you feel at all that they might
depend
on this?
Meaning, who might feel it?
The Romans would say, okay, now they're going to turn on Christians.
In other words, the Christians might feel once they're done with the Jews, they're going to turn on us.
Right.
So let's.
The Romans were already destroying Christians, already after Christians.
Right, this is true.
They fed them to lions.
Right, what we're going to do in subsequent classes is discuss from the Roman perspective, at what point in history do the Romans begin to realize that Jews and Christians are actually different? It takes quite some time for this to occur. Yes?
How do they consider themselves? Do they consider themselves a separate group, or do they consider themselves part of the Jewish?
Okay, so as usual, Mr. Deegan blows the top right off of everything. This is the essential question that we're going to have to ask ourselves. Christians during this period, I think we assume as a matter of course, must have viewed themselves as a separate entity, distinct from Jews. In other words, there are Christians, there's a religion called Christianity, and a religion called Judaism, and the only question is, would the Christians have allied themselves with this other group, the Jews, or would they have opposed this other group, the Jews? And then we sort of stick them in between the rock of Judaism and the hard place of the Romans. I think what Mr. Deegan is pointing out is that we have to actually think back to what we know from previous classes and what we've seen in previous classes, which is, at this point, to speak of Judaism and Christianity as two separate entities and Christians and Jews as representing two separate polities is an anachronism. So once we, and, you know, in other words, we've built an entire edifice, a methodological edifice upon which we can situate our assumptions in this respect. In other words, we've seen so much of what we've seen last semester and this semester has been that at this point we can't really speak of Judaism and Christianity. We can speak of Jews, some of whom believe X, some of whom believe Y, and alongside those Jews, there is a Gentile element that also believes in Jesus that has to negotiate with the Jews who believe in Jesus as to what their identity ultimately is. So we saw Paul has one shita, which is basically Gentiles and Jews doesn't really matter, although we saw that he's somewhat inconsistent. Then we see, on the other hand, there's James and Peter, to a lesser extent, who believe that there are Jews who must remain Jews and observe Torah law, and Gentiles can sort of do what they've always done, which is adopt some Jewish practices and not adopt others. But if they want to really be Jewish and part of the chosen people, they need a bris milah. That's what we've seen so far. So what I'd like to just quickly do, just, yeah.
Using the word church, fathers, when did the synagogue become a church, the Christians?
In other words, right, who are the church fathers and what does that mean?
Church.
Right, so this is something that would take us far afield. We're going to examine this in a later class. Who are the church fathers and what does it mean to be a church father? What does it mean to have a synagogue on one hand and the church on the other? We're going to examine this when we do our unit on the ancient synagogue, the archaeology of the ancient synagogue, who was there, what did they do in the synagogue, who sat where, were there machitas? So we're going to have to examine this when we do the Beis Knesses, the ancient Beis Knesses. However, for now, what I'd like to do is the following. I'd like to break down the thesis that we've propagated so far, which is basically that Christians could not, definitionally, have supported Bar Kokhba and participated in the revolt on the side of the Jews because they believed in a certain Messiah, and Bar Kokhba represented an alternate, oppositional, antichrist type of Messiah. A, and B, therefore, Bar Kokhba would have persecuted the Christians as a result of this, because they represented an antithesis to their class. So you're right, the second part is a leap, but we're going to substantiate that leap in just one second. So one more question before we move on to the first source.
Is there a concept of the first Messiah and the second Messiah?
Yes.
Could we then believe that maybe Bar Kokhba is the fourth Messiah, who will be killed by the Romans, and then Jesus comes along?
A Mashiach Bar Yosef, right. There are traditions that make that assumption. Tagumim. Right, so if we had had extra time last semester, we would have gone through the different views of different groups of Jews in earlier periods about who was the Messiah, how many Messiahs were there, what Shevet were they from. Some of them assumed, as a matter of course, that it was from David. Some assumed that it was actually from Levi. Some assumed that there was one from David, one from Levi, one from David, one from Yosef. It gets very, very complex. At this point, it's unclear, but I actually think this is a very important point that Dr. Schwartzbaum is making. In other words, if we assume that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach, self-identified as a Mashiach, which sort of Mashiach would he be? What's the assumption underlying this question? That Bar Kokhba self-identified as the Messiah. So, in other words, the thesis that we've articulated just far is built on, I think, three core assumptions. One, in the reverse order that we're going to deal with them, one, that Christians would have been persecuted by Bar Kokhba. Actually, you know, before we deal with the assumptions, let's look at source number one, because it's going to help us tease out what these assumptions would have been. So just I want to get through source number one. So take a look at source number one. This is from Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr is of all the church historians that write about this period, Justin Martyr is the only one that really lived during the period of the Bar Kokhba revolt, although he wasn't in Eretz Yisrael, according to his own testimony at the time of the revolt. Justin Martyr lived during the second century of the Common Era. He wrote the work that we're about to examine, the First Apology, which he addressed to the Roman Emperor Antoninus. He wrote this about 15 to 20 years after the Bar Kokhba revolt. And what he does in this section is, it's in the middle of a long section where he describes how the Christians were more adept than the Jews at interpreting the Tanakh, in particular the Nevi'im, and he goes on at length about how the Christians were superior, more civilized, more enlightened than the Jewish people, and in the middle of this he makes the following claim. But these Jews, though they read the books of the prophets, fail to grasp their meaning, and they consider us as their enemies and adversaries. In other words, the Jews know the books of the prophets, they keep the books of the prophets, and as Justin Martyr says in the line before this, they preserve the words of the Nevi'im, but they don't know how to interpret them as well as the Christians, and therefore they hate the Christians. So what do? They kill us, they punish us, just as you the Romans do, whenever they're able to do so, as you can readily imagine. What's his prime example for Jewish persecution of Christians? In the recent Jewish war, Bar Kokhba, this is the term, that the name that he uses for Bar Kokhba, is in the Greek there, I've given you Bar Kokhbas. So he identifies the person called Bar Kokhba. We're going to see what his real name was in a moment, because we have his letters. But he refers to him as Bar Kokhba. So before we move any further, what does Bar Kokhba indicate about how that person would have self-identified? What does Bar Kokhba mean literally? Right, son of the star. What star is this referring to? All right, the Mashiach, right? The Pasuk in Bamidbar says, and as we're going to see in the Yerushalmi in a moment, Darach Kochav mi Yaakov, right? A star shall go out from Yaakov. This has traditionally been interpreted as a reference to the Messiah. So the reference to this person, whose name was in fact, as we'll see in a moment, Shimon ben Kosiba, the nickname appended to him here by Justin Martyr, as Bar Kokhba, seems to be a reference to him as a messianic figure, right? He is the son of the star prophesied about in Sefer Bamidbar. So, in any event, keep that in the back of your mind for a moment, because we're going to have to return to it. But in any event, he says, in the recent Jewish war, Bar Kokhba, the leader of the Jewish uprising, ordered that only the Christians should be subjected to dreadful torments unless they renounced and blasphemed Jesus Christ. So what's the claim that Justin Martyr is making here? There are two claims that he's making. One is just the factual claim that what did Bar Kokhba do to Christians? He persecutes them, he torments them, and then he's making a rhetorical claim, which is
renounce Jesus Christ.
Yes, right. That Bar Kokhba persecuted them for a specific reason, which is that they believed in Jesus, and Bar Kokhba wanted them to believe in Bar Kokhba. And so he persecuted them because they refused to do one and instead opted for the other. So how would you interpret this?
You're just interpreting it because of the idea of Christ as Messiah, but you know, why can't it be because he wants them to be Jewish as opposed to believing in him?
Okay, so they're right. That's another way of reading it, but I think ultimately it comes to the same thing, which is that he wanted, in other words, Justin Martyr is saying Bar Kokhba identified a certain group of people, notably not all Gentiles, just Christians, and insisted that they all renounce their Christianity. That may be one way to read what Justin Martyr is saying.
Unless Justin Martyr is speaking of Christians in general in his writing to the Roman, but the reality is there's a fair number of Jewish Christians that have now, I know it's in, are they Jews, are they Christians,
right,
whatever it is, and Bar Kokhba is leading the Jewish revolt, and Bar Kokhba is saying, unless you come back to our side,
right,
you know, then you're on the wrong side of this war, and we're going to treat you as if you're on the wrong side of this war. And how do we know if the whole idea of Bar Kokhba and the Kochav and everything else isn't even a relation to the whole Jesus story and the star of Bethlehem and all this?
Right, so the star definitely is understood to be a messianic symbol in all of Judaism, and that whether it's the New Testament, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Talmud Yerushalmi, as we're going to see, it's always understood to be a messianic symbol. But I think the point that you're making ultimately devolves to the same issue, which is that Bar Kokhba was persecuting Christians, and only Christians, not Romans, not Greeks, not people from Cyprus, not people from Cyrenaica. He was persecuting Christians because he thought there was something particularly offensive about Christianity to what he represented. Is that fair? Right. In other words, he found something objectionable about what Christians in particular do, and he wanted them to stop doing that. According to Justin Martyr, he wanted them to renounce Jesus. Okay, so
how do you know
whether or not they did, it's clear from Justin Martyr that Bar Kokhba did two things. One, he persecuted Christians, or at least this is what Justin Martyr claims. He persecuted Christians and killed Christians, and more importantly, only Christians. He makes that point explicitly. He only killed Christians. Why? Because they believed in Jesus and he wanted them to stop. Okay. Now, it happens to be that we'll get back to the problems with Justin in a moment. But basic thesis that we have now, that we made at the that we articulated at the beginning of this class, seems to have been substantiated, right? Bar Kokhba is a messianic leader who's persecuting Christians because they believe in something else that is offensive to Bar Kokhba. So now there are three basic assumptions that underlie this approach and this particular interpretation of Justin Martyr, which is this. Bar Kokhba, if he had persecuted Christians, which we're going to have to substantiate, if he had persecuted Christians, he would have done so because they were Christians and not for any other reason. A. B. This rests on the further assumption that Bar Kokhba himself self-identified as the Messiah, as Mashiach. And that rests on the further assumption that the revolt of Bar Kokhba was a messianic revolt, was a revolt that had messianic undertones. So those, I think, are the three assumptions that this entire argument rests on. That he would have persecuted Christians because they were Christians and not for any other reason. That Bar Kokhba saw himself as the Mashiach. And three, that the revolt itself had any messianic content at all. Those are the three assumptions. We're going to have to break them down. I'd like to break them down in reverse order. We're going to see if we can build any of this from the ground up. So number one, we're going to have to figure out the following. Here's our question. Was the Bar Kokhba revolt a messianic revolt? In other words, can we identify the aims of the Bar Kokhba revolt and then say that those aims or those goals that Bar Kokhba and his fighters hoped to accomplish must have been messianic goals or must have had some sort of messianic content? That's question number one. So what we're going to do is, in terms of figuring out what the point of the Bar Kokhba revolt was, so unfortunately our sources don't really tell us. Some of the later Christian sources, which are unreliable, attempt to provide reasons, but they're not very convincing. All we have left are the archaeological and numismatic, which means coins. We have the archaeological resources left us. So we're going to have to interpret the archaeological remains from the Bar Kokhba period, and we're going to have to approximate as best as we can what the purpose, what the goal of the revolt was. And I think we're actually well positioned to do this. Take a look at source number two. I've given you three things. On the left, I've given you two maps. These are called distribution maps. What a distribution map is it gives you a piece of territory. If you look on the right-hand side, it shows a picture of Israel with a little gray box, and that's the area that's being portrayed in both of these maps. So it's basically Yehuda and Shomron. A distribution map takes a certain feature in archaeology, and it shows you on a map all of the places where those things have been found. So you can get an idea of the people who would have been using those things, where would they be located on a map, where did they live. So on the left-hand side, I've given you a distribution map of all the places where coins that were minted by Bar Kokhba, when he, over the course of his revolt, in the areas that he conquered, he minted coins that he distributed to those places and attempted to institute as currency. These things served a propaganda function for him, as coins often do, and this was his way of asserting his rulership over this area. And on the right-hand side, I've given you a distribution map, and all of those little red dots, each one represents a place in Yehuda and Shomron where a refuge cave or a hiding cave, these are sort of these rock, these dugout caves underneath towns that were used by the Bar Kokhba revolt or the Bar Kokhba forces to hide from the Romans and to mount guerrilla attacks on the Roman forces. You can go to Israel nowadays, you can climb into some of these. There's one in Beit Guvrin that everybody goes to. And I was, used to go to Israel as a camper, they used to always take us to Beit Guvrin. So if you go to Israel now, you can climb into some of these refuge caves. So the one on the right hand side shows where all of these refuge caves were found. So now, what I like to do is try and figure out if we can look at these maps, which show, basically, places where Bar Kokhba's power would have been strongest, right? Places where his coins are found and places where his hideouts were found. And we're going to have to see if we can figure out a common denominator between them and then try to figure out what that common denominator tells us. So take a look at the distribution map of the coins on the left. Now, I've framed in these yellow boxes, places where these coins cluster. So now what can we say about these places? Now, if you take a look at the map here, you have Yerushalayim over here. Yerushalayim is over here. Now the coins cluster to the south, over here, along in the hills and in the Midbar Yehuda area, and up north in the territory of Binyamin and the southern territory of Ephraim. So, if we want to figure out where Bar Kokhba would have been most powerful, where his coins would be distributed the most, were going essentially to be given two places where Bar Kokhba would have been powerful. To the south of Yerushalayim and to the northwest of Yerushalayim. Now, take a look to the right and the distribution map of the hiding complexes. So again, you'll see Yerushalayim is over here. It's over here, the same place where it is in the other map. The complexes, again, cluster in the same place in the northwest, Binyamin and Ephraim. And then, in the south, they cluster in roughly the same place in what's called the Shvela, in the valleys just to the east of the coastal plain where Gaza is. Now, given these maps, which are very dry and boring and so forth, if we had to figure out why Bar Kokhba, it's clear that Bar Kokhba's forces were clustered in these places because we find his coins and also his hiding places in the exact same place. Now, if Bar Kokhba was most powerful in these areas, what would that indicate about what Bar Kokhba was trying to achieve? Why would Bar Kokhba have been in this area? Ah, Yerushalayim is right nearby. Now, I will give you one archaeological fact, and that is that in all of the excavations in Yerushalayim, not a single Bar Kokhba, rather I think three have been found out of 13,000 coins, three Bar Kokhba coins have been found in Yerushalayim. So it's clear that Bar Kokhba never made it to Yerushalayim. But the vast majority of his coins, when they number the years that Bar Kokhba was counting from, right, he would made up his own years, they're always year one, L'chayrut Yisrael, right, year one for the redemption of Israel, and many of them say Yerushalayim on it. So it's clear, I think, as you've all intuited, that what Bar Kokhba was doing in this area, in other words, why is Bar Kokhba here as opposed to in the north? There are Romans in the north in the Galil as well. Why aren't they in the Negev? There are Romans in the Negev as well. Why are they here? Why do his coins all say Yerushalayim on them? Why? That's the goal. He wants to capture Yerushalayim. Now, what does he want to do in Yerushalayim? If you could guess.
Reestablish the commonwealth.
In other words, reestablish a Jewish state, right? Build a capital building there. What was the other?
I was saying that if the book was about the Beis HaMikdash, that they built a temple on the Beis HaMikdash. So he's trying to cleanse the area, trying to get rid of
Ilia Capitolina, trying to get rid of the temple to Jupiter that the Romans had built on top of the Beis HaMikdash. I would argue that his goals were, in fact, more ambitious than that. Take a look at the coins. I've given you two coins here. Two coins, and we're going to have to interpret them. The one on the left is one side of a coin that says, it says Yerushalayim on it, so you know what his goal was. Now, what do you see on the coin on the left? This is a large silver coin. It's worth about 4 dinar. What do we see there? What do we see? There's a building. It's the Beis HaMikdash. How do we know it's the Beis HaMikdash? Well, first of all, we know from other areas that this is exactly how the Beis HaMikdash is always depicted. But what do we see? Now, if we see a building, there are four columns, and what's inside those columns? Right, it's the Aron Kodesh. Right, so this is the Beis HaMikdash, and it says Yerushalayim on it. So this is something that Bar Kokhba put on all of his coins, for the most part, from the first year of his revolt. Another important thing, if you look on the coin to the right, so this is the script that you see on here, is called Paleo Hebrew, it's old Hebrew script. The script that we use now is Assyrian Hebrew script. This is old Hebrew script. What it says, for those of you who read Paleo Hebrew, it says Elazar, and then there's a hey right before, there's a hey in the wrong place, but it says Elazar HaKohen, right? Elazar the Kohen. We know from the letters of Bar Kokhba that this was an administrator, this was one of Bar Kokhba's right-hand men. He didn't have any military function. His function was solely to be a Kohen, right? So combining these two things, it becomes clear that what was Bar Kokhba's goal? He had a Kohen as his right-hand man. He put his name on his coins. He put the picture of the Beis HaMikdash on his coins with the Aron Kodesh, even though the Aron Kodesh had long since disappeared. What was his goal? Exactly. To conquer Yerushalayim and to reestablish the Beis HaMikdash. This seems to have been Bar Kokhba's goal. He didn't achieve it, but this seems to have been Bar Kokhba's goal.
Is there a text in the middle of the coin on the left?
In the middle of the coin on the left? Yes, I mean it says Yerushalayim. It says Yerushalayim around the edges.
No, in the center. Like to me, and I'm not wearing my glasses. To me, it's a chair.
Over
with
here.
The base of a chair.
Oh.
And that's the back of a chair, and it's a throne. And I don't know what those letters are.
Ah, so these are not letters. These are just dots on the Aron Kodesh. And what you see on the bottom there is actually meant to represent the courtyards of the Beis HaMikdash.
Could the revolt have started out to liberate Yerushalayim, reestablish the Beis HaMikdash, and then it morphed into Bar Kokhba, and now
you know, declaring that he is the calling, you know, the Mashiach, that it starts in one way, and then
it eventually develops.
Right,
so before we move on, so the next thing that we're going to discuss is how did Bar Kokhba self-identify? That's actually a question that we can answer with some certainty. Or at least, if not certainty, at least some degree of confidence. But at this point, just in terms of, again, and the methodology that we always try to employ in this class is, we figure out what our evidence is, we gather all our evidence together, and then come to the most extensive conclusion we can based on the evidence alone. So based on this evidence alone, we know that Bar Kokhba's goal, as we said, was to conquer Yerushalayim and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash because, as Dr. Schwartzman pointed out before, there is a big, fat, disgusting, ugly, offensive to Jews Roman temple on top of the Beis HaMikdash. So they wanted to get rid of that. Now, need this have been a messianic goal? What precedent is there for getting rid of an offensive thing that was in the Beis HaMikdash? Hanukkah, right? We just had Hanukkah, right? There's the Maccabean precedent for this. Was the Maccabean revolt a messianic revolt? Presumably not. In fact, we know it wasn't. So it wasn't. We're going to see an example, just one more example in a second of another revolt that was extremely similar to this that also did not have messianic goals, but we'll save that for a moment. So, at most, what we know about the revolt, in other words, the assumption about the revolt, that it was a messianic revolt, I think we can, if not dispense with it, at least we can question it. In other words, all that we know about the goals of the revolt was that it intended to destroy something offensive to the Jewish people and reinstitute something that the Jewish people were very proud of, which was the Beis HaMikdash. That's the most that we know, given our evidence about the goal, about Bar Kokhba's goals. Bar Kokhba wanted to recapture the temple, destroy what was on it, and rebuild what was there previously. That's all we know. Any questions? Yes.
Justin Arthur said that he was trying to get rid of Christians, but that was his concern. How do we know that he didn't have a bigger program than that to get rid of any other competing groups and just establish one?
Right. So this is a good question, and I think it actually is a perfect segue into what we're going to talk about now. In other words, let's assume for the moment that Bar Kokhba's goals weren't necessarily messianic, but perhaps Bar Kokhba himself saw himself as having a greater role than just rebuilding a temple. He saw himself as rebuilding a temple and ushering in the Messianic Age. Maybe Bar Kokhba, although his goals seem somewhat generic to us, if not generic in an emotional and theological sense, but generic in a historical sense, if his goals seem generic, perhaps he himself was not generic. Perhaps he himself was unique, or extraordinary at least, in asserting that he was a Mashiach. So, the question number two, and this is the second assumption that we made before, the assumption number two was that Bar Kokhba self-identified as the Mashiach. And people generally understood and knew that when Bar Kokhba came into town, the Mashiach was coming into town, riding on his horse, as the Talmud Bavli tells us. So, did Bar Kokhba self-identify as the Mashiach? Take a look at the sources in source number three. Here, we actually have rather rabbinic evidence. So here we have sources from Chazal, but it's rather more ambiguous than it's normally made out to be. In other words, everybody knows that there was a rabbinic position on Bar Kokhba, and what was that position? And who is responsible for this position? Rabbi Akiva, and what was his position on Bar Kokhba? Everybody knows that Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. Now, take a look at the Talmud Yerushalmi. I've given you the ground zero. There are two sources that are basically contemporaneous for this notion. One is in Eicha Rabbah and one is here in Yerushalmi. They're somewhat problematic textually, but we're going to do the best that we can with the evidence that we have. So, take a look at the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi tells us, Tani Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Akiva Rebbe, Haya Doresh, Darach Kochav Miyakov, Darach Koziva Miyakov. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who lived a generation after the Bar Kokhba revolt, and was a student of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai tells us the following. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai tells us that my Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, used to darshan the pasuk in Sefer Bamidbar that says, from Parashas Balak, Darach Kochav Miyakov, he used to darshan it as, instead of Darach Kochav Miyakov, in Aramaic, Kochav would have been Kochva, instead of Darach Kochva Miyakov, Darach Kozva, Koziva Miyakov. Koziva was the patronymic, the name by which Bar Kokhba was known in real life, and that's how he signed his letters, Shimon ben Koziva. So according to this source in the Talmud Yerushalmi, apparently Rabbi Akiva took a pasuk that is normally associated with messianic notions and asserted that it was referring to, or that it was foretelling the rise of Shimon ben Koziva, of Bar Kokhba. So notice, there's no, and I'll point this out, I'll just make a general note, there's no source in anywhere in Chazal that for calling this person Bar Kokhba. He's never called Bar Kokhba anywhere in Chazal. At most, he's called Ben Koziva, as we have here. Ben Koziva means, and this is the way that it's taken in Talmud Bavli, Ben Koziva means the son of the lie, and it's a pun on his actual name, which was Kosiba, with a samach, or a sin. Ben Koziva means the son of the lie, potentially. At least that's how it's taken by the Talmud Bavli. And what would that be referring to, therefore? It would be referring to Bar Kokhba not as a Mashiach, but as a false Mashiach. Right? So the most that we know is that there's no source that calls Bar Kokhba Bar Kokhba. There are sources that refer to Bar Kokhba as a false Mashiach, but nothing that refers to him as Bar Kokhba as the real Mashiach. All we have here is Rabbi Akiva saying that Bar Kokhba apparently is the Mashiach. And he goes further. Rabbi Akiva, the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us, Rabbi Akiva, Karavachami Bar Koziva, when Rabbi Akiva met Shimon ben Koziva, what did he say? He said, Hava Amar, Dein hu Malka Mashiach. This is the King Messiah. Doesn't get more explicit than this. Right? So apparently, without going into all the textual problems, Rabbi Akiva, at the very least, is one person who asserts that Bar Kokhba is the Mashiach, that Shimon ben Koziva, Bar Kokhba, is the Mashiach. Right, so
figure out that he wasn't after all.
The tradition that we have about Bar Kokhba, which we reference on Yom Kippur and we reference on Tisha B'Av, is that Bar Kokhba Rabbi Akiva was martyred during the persecutions, probably that followed the Bar Kokhba revolt. So presumably he saw the failure. Presumably he either saw he either suffered as a result of Bar Kokhba losing, or he perhaps saw the failure of Rabbi Akiva of Bar Kokhba. Either way, Rabbi Akiva at a certain point should have figured out that Bar Kokhba was not Mashiach. And in fact, the Talmud Bavli, this is not an historical source, but the Talmud Bavli imagines the Bar Kokhba revolt ending as follows. Bar Kokhba comes before the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin decides that he's a false Mashiach, and they put him to death. So in other words, Chazal at a certain point themselves are well aware that Bar Kokhba was not the real Mashiach. That he was close to Tshuva, basically. So we don't have anything of that sort, potentially. Right, so we don't really have anything of that sort. However, what I'd like to draw your attention to is the conclusion of this Talmud Yerushalmi, which generally doesn't make it into the popular discussions of this issue, and that is, Amalei Rav Yochanan ben Tarta. Rav Yochanan ben Tarta responds to Rabbi Akiva as follows: Akiva yalu asavim belechayich. Or rather, belechayayich, va'adayin ben David lo yavo. Grass will grow between your jaws. In other words, you'll be long dead before the Mashiach ever comes. In other words, Bar Kokhba is not the Mashiach. So here, we're presented with a problem, which is that we have seemingly contradictory evidence. Right? We have, on the one hand, Rabbi Akiva saying that Bar Kokhba is the Mashiach. Now, it happens to be that in Eicha Rabbah, this view of Rabbi Akiva is reported by Rabbi Yochanan, who lived four or five generations after Rabbi Akiva. So it's unclear if this is a statement made by Rabbi Akiva or something that people assumed Rabbi Akiva must have said, but let's assume that Rabbi Akiva actually said this. Let's assume that Rabbi Akiva actually believed that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. Now, all that means is that Rabbi Akiva, and only Rabbi Akiva, believed that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. We can't possibly know more than that, especially because we have another Tana, albeit not as famous or as accomplished as Rabbi Akiva by far, Rabbi Yochanan ben Tarta, who responds to Rabbi Akiva very sharply and says, of course he's not the Mashiach. What, are you nuts? So, in terms of figuring out how Bar Kokhba self-identified, we don't really seem to have much material here, because what we basically have is a dispute between Jews about whether or not Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. So it's, in other words, it might be, at this point in terms of where we are in our evidence, it might be that Bar Kokhba said he was the Mashiach and there were those who rejected that, or it could be that Bar Kokhba didn't say anything and then there were people like Rabbi Akiva who made the argument on his behalf that he was the Mashiach. Those are both possibilities. We can think of a recent example of where this might be the case as well. Right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe. In other words, the Lubavitcher Rebbe never said he was Mashiach. There were those who made that argument on his behalf, and there are brutal, acerbic debates that continue to this day as to whether, as to which position is the Iker and which position is the Tafel, which position is primary and which is secondary. But we can well imagine a similar phenomenon here. In other words, did Bar Kokhba say he was Mashiach and there were people who rejected that? Or did Bar Kokhba not say anything and there were those who attempted to make that case? So that's as far as we know right now. We actually are in a position, however, to go even further than this because we have Bar Kokhba's personal letters. Many of them have been discovered in the Judean desert, and we have the texts of some of the letters that he either personally wrote or had transcribed on his behalf. And we can figure out a little bit about how Bar Kokhba self-identified, because he signs these letters and identifies himself in the letters. And he gives himself, in fact, a title. And the question we're going to have to ask is, does this tell us anything about how he perceived himself? So take a look at the source on the right-hand side. And that is, I've labeled Pi Adin 54. It's because it's a papyrus that was discovered by the famous Israeli archaeologist Yigali Adin, Alav HaShalom. And the letter, and we're going to examine the rest of the letter in just a moment, the letter begins as follows. Shimon bar Kosiba, hanasi al Yisrael, liyahonatan al namasabala salam. Shimon, son of Kosiba, the nasi over Israel, to Yehonatan and Masabala, peace. Yehonatan and Masabala were two of Bar Kokhba's captains who were living in En Gedi during the revolt. And this is a letter that Bar Kokhba addresses to his two lieutenants. And how does he identify himself? What's the term that he uses? Right, Nasi al Yisrael. So the question is, what does Nasi mean? President, prince, leader. Now, it happens to be that in Yechezkel, the eventual Davidic heir who's going to rule over the Jewish people in the days of, presumably, the Mashiach, is going to be a melech. And one of the words that Yechezkel uses at the end of the prophecy to describe him is Nasi. So it could be, Nasi could be a messianic title. However, the vast, vast, vast majority of occurrences of this term in Chumash and in Second Temple Judaism do not have messianic overtones, but rather just have administrative overtones. In other words, you are a Nasi because you're a prince, you're a king, you're the ruler over territory. In some cases, like in Divrei Yamim, you're the ruler over armies. So the term Nasi, as opposed to the term Melech, which might have had more important messianic connotations, the term Nasi is actually a pretty pyrrhic term that denotes leadership, just plain leadership. Now, we know that Bar Kokhba saw himself as a leader. He minted coins, he ran an army, he held territory. So it's natural that Bar Kokhba identified himself as a general, a generalissimo, right? Some sort of ruler in an administrative sense. What he doesn't refer to himself as ever is Bar Kokhba. He never uses the term Bar Kokhba to describe himself. He never uses the term Mashiach to describe himself. He never uses the term Kochav or in any of its derivations to describe himself. All he calls himself is Shimon Bar Kosiva the Nasi. So at this point, what we seem to have is a case where Shimon ben Kosiba refers to himself as a leader, simply that. There are those who saw in his actions messianic implications. One of them was Rabbi Akiva. There were others, even amongst Chazal, who disagreed with this assessment of Bar Kokhba. And in fact, it was a pretty natural reading of Bar Kokhba, because all Bar Kokhba saw himself as was basically, let's say, the reincarnation of the Maccabees, right? In other words, Bar Kokhba is essentially trying to accomplish the same thing as the Maccabees. He's trying to conquer Yerushalayim, raise the offensive structure that was built on top of the Beis HaMikdash, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and establish Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. It was very natural to see himself as the Nasi, as the prince. Very natural. And in fact, those of you who are around last semester when we did our class on Masada will recall that we have almost the exact same description of a rebel leader in the first Jewish revolt against Rome that resulted in the destruction of Bais Sheni, where we can in fact observe the same exact thing going on. A person who described himself as a prince or a king, who attempted to take over the Beis HaMikdash, rebuild it, reestablish Jewish sovereignty over the land, and who had absolutely no messianic pretensions whatsoever. So take a look at the source I've given you from Josephus, just below this. This is referring to the course of the Jewish revolt against Rome, as I said, that resulted in the destruction of Vaishani. And it tells us the following about one of the charismatic, and for a time at least, successful leaders of the Jewish rebellion against Rome, whose name is Menachem. At this time, a certain Menachem, son of Judas, the one called the Galilean, a most formidable sophist who had berated the Judeans back in the time of Quirinius because they were subjecting themselves to the Romans after God. In other words, so Josephus is telling us here, and this will become important in a moment, that this Menachem, who was the who, as we'll see, was the leader of the rebels, was the son, or at least the descendant, of Judas the Galilean. Judas the Galilean was the first person, all the way in the beginning of the first century of the Common Era, who tried to tell Jews that they were slaves to Rome and they should assert their freedom and their liberty by breaking away from Rome and doing their own thing, their own Jewish thing. So this Menachem, who was descended from this great libertarian, took his acquaintances and withdrew to Masada, and there, after he broke open the armory of King Herod, in other words, he, as we saw last semester, he retreated to where his friends, who were called the Sicarii, they were the sort of Jewish rebels who would stab people, so he retreats back to Masada, where his friends are holding the fort. He gets some weapons, and then what does he do? He returned to Yerushalayim quite like a king, a Basileus. Basileus is king. It's the equivalent of Melech. In some old Greek sources, it actually is the equivalent of prince, like the word Nasi. In the Odyssey, in Aristotle, it's used that way. And after becoming commander of the civil strife, he began organizing the siege, both the reduction of the secure places and the death of the high priest Hananiah, deluded Menachem to the point of savagery, thinking that he had no rival in affairs. He was an unbearable tyrant. So Josephus is making the point here that this Menachem, in becoming a king, was basically subverting the values of his grandfather, right? His grandfather was this big, you know, libertarian, Republican, small r, right? Was this big believer in classical liberty, and here Menachem becomes this tyrant, this civil administrative tyrant who's ruling over the city of Yerushalayim. Now, Josephus tells us nothing, gives us no hint that this Menachem, who was basically also trying to capture Yerushalayim, raise the, in other words, re-establish Jewish control over the temple, and defeat the Roman armies, and establish Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, there's no hint that he had any messianic pretensions whatsoever. And the fact that he refers to himself as a king also doesn't indicate that he was the Mashiach. He just was an administrative, military, civilian ruler. That is what Menachem was. And I would argue that is, in fact, how Bar Kokhba presented himself, how Shimon ben Koziva presented himself. At most, therefore, dealing with assumption number two, which is that Bar Kokhba self-identified as a messianic leader and would have been perceived as such by others, I think we can dispense with this as well. Why? Number one, number one, the name, Bar Kokhba, which indicates messianism, we have no contemporary sources that refer to him as actually Bar Kokhba, nothing in Chazal. In Christian sources, these sources date from at least the 4th century, 200, 300 years later, at the earliest. The only exception is Justin Martyr. The problem, though, is that Justin Martyr, the text of Justin Martyr, which we saw earlier, is preserved in a single manuscript from the 14th century that seems to have been altered many, 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 many times. So the term Bar Kokhba may have been inserted there. So at most, we have no evidence that anyone ever called in his lifetime Shimon ben Koziva Bar Kokhba, number one. Number two, we know that Shimon ben Koziva Bar Kokhba himself never called himself the Mashiach. At most, he gave himself a term that might be messianic, but might, in fact, like in the case of Menachem during the First Revolt, just be a pariv term for military leader, namely Nasi. And three, we have a machlokes Tanaim, we have a dispute amongst the Tanaim about whether or not Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. So at most, we can say the following up until now. The revolt does not seem to have any aims that were specifically messianic. Bar Kokhba himself does not seem to have self-identified as the Mashiach. There may have been those, however, those Jews, maybe, who thought that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach or that he had messianic potential. That's the most that we can say. And then finally, assumption number one that we dealt with before, which is that if it was true, if it is true, and it may be, that Bar Kokhba persecuted people who self-identified as Christians or followers of Jesus, that he would have done that because they were Christians, and he found that offensive. That's assumption number one or three, depending on what we're counting, that we're going to have to deal with. So I think before we even examine this, we can make 2 points, which is the basis of this assumption seems to have been eviscerated. In other words, we've pulled the rug out from under this assumption. Why? Because what we've established so far is that, in fact, Bar Kokhba's revolt need not have been seen as messianic even by Jews, even by people who did not follow Jesus. In other words, it's manifestly untrue to assert that all Jews would have taken it as self-evident that the Bar Kokhba revolt was a messianic revolt. At best, there were some who thought that, and there were others, probably including Bar Kokhba himself, who did not think that. Now, what we do have is Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr tells us that Bar Kokhba killed Christians. He probably couldn't have written that because he was living at a time when people would have been alive to contradict this. He probably couldn't have written that if that wasn't true. So let's assume, naniach, that Bar Kokhba killed some Christians. Now, why would he have killed these Christians? Justin Martyr argues that it was because they were Christians, because they believed in Jesus. Need that have been the case? Maybe he saw them as Romans, but let's assume that he saw them as Jews. Everything we've seen until now indicates that people would have seen Christians during this period as Jews, right? Let's say he saw them as Jews. Why would he have killed people who were Christians? Take a look at source number 4. There is something else that we know about Bar Kokhba. We know a little bit about his personality. And his personality, to say the least, was aggressive. Take a look at I've given you the hemshech of the papyrus that we looked at earlier, papyrus number 54. In the second column of this papyrus, he gives his commanders, Yonasan and Masabala, he gives them instructions about what to do with people who lived in Tekoa, who were not Christians. They just lived in Tekoa. They presumably had offended Bar Kokhba in some way. We'll try to identify what that was in a moment. And this is what he says about them. He writes in Aramaic, V'chol gvar Tekoi, di yitshakach levatchon, bate di enon sharyon, begohan yikadun. Any person from Tekoa who is found with you, i.e. who's living in Engedi at the time, let the houses in which they reside be burnt to the ground. And if you don't do that, I will punish you. The people of Tekoa appear several times in the letters of Bar Kokhba, and he's always mad at them. So Bar Kokhba, apparently, went around killing people and burning their houses down if they didn't do what he liked. Now, what might he not have liked about the people of Tekoa? Take a look at the source to the right of this. This is Eusebius. Eusebius, a Christian, who argues in another place in his writings that Bar Kokhba killed, he quotes Justin Martyr as saying, and he quotes the passage that we saw from Justin Martyr as saying that Bar Kokhba killed Christians because they were Christians. In another place, quoting another source, he quotes something that suggests something else and gives us a possible hint as to why Bar Kokhba would kill people. Kokhbas, right? He thought that was his proper name. Kokhbas, Duke of the Jewish sect, killed Christians with all kinds of persecutions when they refused to help him against the Roman troops. So here, why is Bar Kokhba killing people who are Christians?
Because
they're not helping. Does that mean, why would they not have helped?
The traitors.
Traitors. That's the best term I would use. He kills Christians, not because they believe in Jesus, but for the same reason that he probably was killing the Tekoans. Right? The Tekoans had fled from Tekoa, had relocated to Ein Gedi, right? They kind of moved out of the settlements, and they now moved to moved back inside the Green Line. So why is he upset at the people from Tekoa? Because they retreated. They retreated. They were cowards. They surrendered. They were draft dodgers. So why is he killing Christians? Some Christians didn't want to fight, so he killed them. Whoever it is, right, whatever the attitude seems to be, without descending into contemporary politics, Bar Kokhba is killing people, whether or not they're Christians, right? They could be Christians, they could just be people who lived in Tekoa and fled to Ein Gedi. He's killing people because they're hurting the war effort, right? They're hurting the war effort against the Romans. So Bar Kokhba is going to be killing people for any reason. It's not going to be because they believed in a Messiah that wasn't him, because we know that Bar Kokhba didn't see himself as the Mashiach. It's not because they were opposing a messianic revolt, because the revolt wasn't messianic. Why was he killing people? Because they were hurting the war effort. They were hurting the war effort. And I would add to this the following piece of evidence, and then we'll conclude. Take a look at the source below this. The source below this is called the Apocalypse of Peter. It's part of the New Testament Apocrypha. In other words, it's not just not in the Old Testament. It's not just in the Old Testament. Not that it's not in the Old Testament Apocrypha. It's not even that it's in the New Testament. It's in the New Testament Apocrypha. So it's like four steps removed from anything that we should, under normal circumstances, care about. However, as an historical source, it's quite valuable. The Apocalypse of Peter is preserved for us by the Ethiopian church. It's Ethiopic, I think. I believe, the Apocalypse of Peter. There are two texts. There's the Achmin text and the Ethiopic text. The Ethiopic text is what this comes from. It's the Ethiopic text. Now, the Apocalypse of Peter, we happen to know, was written in the early part of the second century of the Common Era. In other words, contemporaneously and probably during the Bar Kokhba revolt. It seems to mention the Bar Kokhba revolt, but it doesn't know how it ends. So it was likely written during the Bar Kokhba revolt. Now, this is a Christian text, and it is addressed to members of the House of Israel who are worshippers of Jesus Christ. Right? So it's addressed to people who are A, self-identifying as people who believe in Jesus, and B, self-identifying as Jews. Now, it goes to great lengths, not in this text, but it goes to great lengths to describe a certain false, what it calls a false Christ, a false Messiah, literally, that's literally what that means, a false Christ who is going to kill members of the House of Israel because they don't support him. And it goes at great lengths to sort of attack this person. And then it makes the following claim. And take a look at this. And let's try to divine what might have been, what sentiment, what historical event might have been behind this text. The narrator says, "I was joyful and believed and understood that which is written in the book in the New Testament. And I said to him," in other words, he has a vision of Jesus, and he says to him, "My Lord, do you wish for me to make you here three tabernacles? One for you, one for Moshe, and one for Eliyahu." This is a paraphrase of a verse in Matthew. The verse in Matthew speaks of tents as dwelling places. Here he's speaking about tabernacles, about Bate Mikdash, right? And he said, and Jesus responded, "Satan makes war against you, has veiled your understanding, and the good things of this world conquer you." Now what does he say? Now this is the key line. Jesus says, don't make a Beis HaMikdash for me, don't build a Beis HaMikdash, a tabernacle which the hand of man has not made, but which my heavenly Father has made for me and for the elect, that's what you should build. And we saw it full of joy. We've seen this motif before, that the Christians attempted to spiritualize the temple. We don't need an actual Beis HaMikdash, we needed a heavenly Beis HaMikdash of faith. Right? So here, during the Bar Kokhba revolt, in response to the enemies of people who really believe in Jesus, Christians are being told, don't build a real temple, build a temple of faith. Now, why might they have had to be told this? In other words, what does this suggest? In other words, what does this suggest that people wanted to do? Bar Kokhba was trying to get them to build the temple in Yerushalayim. That much we can say with great confidence was Bar Kokhba's goal. Now, this text is addressed to whom?
Christians.
Jewish Christians, right? Jewish people who follow Jesus. They are being told stridently, and it's emphasized again and again and again, don't build the temple with this false Christ, false Messiah. The fact that Christians need to be told this may suggest what? There were some who were following this person, and they need Musar to be told not to do that. This brings us full circle. The Bar Kokhba revolt was not necessarily and probably wasn't a messianic revolt. Bar Kokhba himself does not seem to have identified as the Mashiach. At best, there were some Jews who thought he was, but others disagreed. Three, Christians who were persecuted were just one group of many Jews who were persecuted by Bar Kokhba for not following his revolt on a military level. And finally, it seems that, in fact, there may have been Jewish Christians who saw no contradiction between fighting on the side of their Jewish brethren in the Bar Kokhba revolt and B, continuing to remain faithful to whatever it is they believed. That seems to be the case that we can build, given the available evidence. In fact, there seems to be very little, if any, evidence for the idea that this was a big messianic episode that finally pit, inevitably, Judaism against Christianity and allowed the Jews and Christians to finally separate themselves. Now, before we finish with the minute and a half that we have remaining, I'd like to make a case for why I think this is extremely important for our modern Orthodox community in particular, not the Jewish community, the modern Orthodox community today, this week. What we've seen over the course of this year, over the course of this class, is that whereas scholars, historians, theologians, rabbinic thinkers assumed that there must have been this big, monumental, cataclysmic event that pit the core commitments of Jews against Christians and made it so that never the twain shall meet, right? Jews had to choose one side, and Christians had to choose the other side. As Mamina said, you're either with us or against us. In fact, what we've seen is a far messier reality. We've seen a reality where some Jews were on the side, some people who were Jews did not believe in Jesus, were on the side of Bar Kokhba. Others were against him. Some thought he was Mashiach, some thought he was not. Some Christians did not fight for Bar Kokhba, were draft dodgers. Some perhaps even didn't fight because they did see this messianic conflict. But others did not see a conflict, and still others may have even fought for Bar Kokhba on the side of the Jews against the Romans. Now, we know that eventually Judaism and Christianity part ways. That much, I think, is self-evident. But this was not the Big Bang theory that we can use to explain that. Now, why would someone have wanted to use this as a... Why would a theologian want to use this as an explanation for how they speak? I think the answer is because it's simple, it's comforting. In a sense, it's simplistic, right? If we want to explain how Judaism and Christianity split, if we want to explain how a religious schism, how a single, cohesive, united community split irrevocably into two, it's very comforting to assume that the only way this could have happened was to have this big, catastrophic, cataclysmic event that split them. In fact, what we've seen so far, what we've seen today, and what we're going to see in the coming weeks, is that no such catastrophic event occurred that irrevocably split the Jewish people into two. It was a long, complicated, intricate, complex process that eventually split a united Jewish people. There's been a lot of talk in recent days, recent weeks, recent months, about the potential for schism within the Orthodox community. There is modern Orthodoxy on the one hand, open Orthodoxy on the other. Someone called me just this past week, a member of closed Orthodoxy. Never heard that before, and I've never been called that before. Someone called me that this week. I think there is a naive assumption on the part of many within the community that our united Orthodox community would never really split, would never really come to schism over any of the issues that are brewing nowadays, because we don't have any sort of cataclysmic event on the horizon that's going to inexorably, unavoidably, inevitably break us apart. There's nothing huge like the Bar Kokhba revolt that will split us in half. In fact, what we know about the Bar Kokhba revolt is that even during the days of the Bar Kokhba revolt, there was no cataclysmic event that split people apart. It was an issue of, as Mrs. Deegan says, day-to-day differences. Eventual, gradual, slow disentanglement of Judaism from Christianity that split the Jewish people into two. Now, there may be good reason, and we may be very happy and grateful that eventually Christianity and Judaism split, because that way we can focus on Chazal, we can focus on the Halacha, we can focus on proper beliefs, and we can focus on a world in which we believe the Mashiach has in fact not arrived, and in fact in which there is one God, not one God with three natures, or three gods, Chas v'Shalom. So it may be a good thing that Judaism and Christianity split. But the schism between Judaism and Christianity was not the result of a huge event that we can never imagine being replicated in our own circumstances in our own day. Schism can take place under the very circumstances that we are experiencing now. And to the extent that we hope and pray that all Jews, and in particular modern Orthodox Jews, will remain part of our community, will remain part of our big tent and part of Klal Yisrael, we have to be very wary of schism. We have to be very wary of a situation under which different strands of the modern Orthodox community will gradually split apart. If we assume there won't be a schism, if we assume there won't be division, disunity, because there's going to, because there won't be some sort of catastrophe, we're wrong. And there will be schism. We have to do what we can. Of course, within the confines of halacha, with the appropriate advice of poskim, and respectfully, and with integrity, but we have to do what we can to keep orthodoxy, to keep modern orthodoxy together. I don't suggest that one or the other side is right, that one or the other side should be given priority. I do have my own opinions, but I think it's crucial that from a social, religious, theological perspective, we value achdus, which I think we should, we have to realize that we are already in crisis. Perhaps no cataclysm is on the horizon, but schism might be. And with that, I will conclude, and we will move on next time to the attitudes of Christianity towards its own history and towards its own, in other words, what were the Christian attitudes, what was the Christian belief as it developed about how it split from Judaism.